Today's episode is sponsored by Femprovisor Fest 18, which will be taking place April 26th through April 29th in beautiful downtown San Francisco. The festival is now accepting submissions from diverse all-lady improv ensembles, comics, and performance artists. This will be the fifth year, and this year's theme is Put Your Hands Together. They'll be focusing on how women can best lift each other up while celebrating their strengths and unique diversity, ultimately coming together as a diverse women's improv collective. Applications for all ladies' acts will be accepted until February 2nd. Submit through the National Improv Network, but you don't have much time. For more information, go to femprovisorfest.com. That's femprovisorfest.com. Are you a seasoned improviser looking for a new approach to your scenic improv? Are you an actor who's always wanted to take improv, but were a little afraid to? Are you new to improv? Well, if you answer yes to any of these questions, I want to let you know about my Intro to Art of Slow Comedy one-day improv workshop right here in Chicago. The goal is simple, to make improv as easy as having a conversation. It will be held Saturday, February 10th from 12:30 to 3:30. I limit this to 14 people so you get personal attention. So, to sign up right now, or for more information, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Feral Audio.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Pete Holmes. You know Pete is the star and creator of his HBO show, Crashing, which is premiering its second season, his podcast, You Made It Weird, and of course, his incredibly funny stand-up. But did you know that Pete started out doing improv in the sixth grade in summer camp, and then in high school, and then all the way through college before moving to Chicago in 2001 to pursue it? So we talked to Pete about his beginning in comedy, which was improv. We talked to him about doing short-form games in a Christian college, moving to Chicago and trying to break into the scene. He talked to us about why being jealous just doesn't make good business sense. We talked about Crashing, his TV show, and taking pain and turning that into comedy. Sad comedy, you know, I love sad comedy. And he told us how sad comedy can work. And also, he took, at the beginning of this episode, a Herculean feat in trying to help me bring more joy into my performing. Because if you watch Pete do his stand-up, he has so much joy. And of course, I want to tap into that. But before we get to that episode, I just want to say I was so excited to interview Pete. I was so excited that HBO, the PR people, contacted us. And that for me, that's a big deal because I don't feel like anyone notices us. But HBO contacted us and said, hey, would you like, they called me up. They left a message on my cell phone. I guess that's how you do it today. And they said, would you like to interview Pete Holmes? He's coming to Chicago, and his HBO show Crashing is starting its second season. And I said, of course I would, because I love Crashing. A friend turned me on to it. A couple friends actually turned me on to it, and I just love it because I love it that he's starting out. His character, Pete's character, is starting out doing stand up in New York. He's not very good at it. He's just getting a divorce from his wife. He's only 28 years old. And there's just a lot of sadness to the show. And it's funny, and I love sad comedy. I really, really love sad comedy. I really appreciate it, especially when it's done well, like Crashing. So I couldn't be more excited and more proud that HBO noticed us and wanted us to interview Pete. So here it is, the Pete Holmes episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Pete Holmes, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Improv Nerd?
I don't approve of that name.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding. Okay. I'm wonderful. I'm an improv nerd. I love it. That's great. Before we start, okay, first of all, I want to say this. You have so much joy on stage, okay? It doesn't matter, if I have a great show, I still sabotage the joy. How do you sabotage your own joy? Oh, yeah, it's tragic.
You know, yeah, there's a sort of fake it till you make it sort of.
So how do you do it? How do you tap into that joy?
I do. I mean, it's never false. It's always coming from a real place, but I like to say it is encouraged. You know what I mean? I'm not like, if I'm laughing at my joke, what I like to say is I could not laugh. You know what I'm saying? It's not like I'm so feathery and bubbly that I have to laugh at my own brilliant joke or something. It's not that. I'm trying to, it's more like getting into some sort of trance or spell on myself and the audience together. So it's not like the show is happening.
How do you get into that trance? Because I wouldn't imagine it, sometimes it doesn't happen, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I've had times when I've been heckled or something in the beginning of the show and I have to like sternly reprimand somebody. The example I'm thinking of is they said something homophobic or something. I'm not gay, but it still offended me deeply. And I was just kind of like, how dare you, basically. Shut the F up. And then I have to like continue. And my act, it just doesn't work. If I don't seem happy and friendly, it doesn't really work. It's not like they're perfectly written jokes like Stephen Wright or just like undeniable observations.
Okay, I'm going inside your brain because I need to know more about this. Are you a happy person generally?
Yeah, okay. But I would say that I focus it in these bursts. Everybody has different parts of their personality, and I'm fortunate that I have compartments for all of them. I think if Val asked you, she would say I'm very silly.
Val is your new wife. You just got married
two months ago.
2 months, congratulations.
It was last year, though.
Right.
2 months ago. I love being silly. I love trying to stay light as I'm doing on stage. That's not to say that I don't struggle with the full range of human emotion. But as people are going into comedy, I'm like, you should pick a voice that allows for all types of expression. And I think I've done that. I'm allowed to get angry on stage. I'm allowed to share vulnerability. I don't have to be, I always think of like Jack McBrayer's character on 30 Rock. I don't have to just be Jack McBrayer. Although what a great improviser.
Right, a great, great, great improviser.
I used to fly out to Chicago just to see Second City. Like for the weekend.
Is that true?
And I would go to ETC and I saw Jack McBrayer. Yeah.
So you were in Boston, were you in college when you did that?
I was in college, yeah. I knew so badly, like the whole plan was to move to Chicago, Clown College, like this kind of.
He's pointing to Joe over there, Joe Pisano.
I've been saying Joel.
You've been saying what?
I've been saying Joel.
Okay.
No, that's a joke. I haven't been saying anything. I've just been looking at him and addressing him directly. But it's Joe.
It's Joe.
Yeah. And Joe. I moved here last year.
And it's Pete, right?
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
Great.
Jimmy. And don't tell me your name.
Right, okay. And your show is crashing. I'm just going to keep
crashing.
Yeah.
I moved here. I used to fly out on the long weekend because I was obsessed with Chicago. I was obsessed with Second City.
From a young age?
No, around the time in college, I did improv in camp.
Mm-hmm. You were in sixth grade. Tell us
sixth
about
grade,
that.
Yeah.
How were you in sixth grade as an improviser?
I mean, everybody was garbage, but not unfortunately, I had that sort of unbridled confidence. I hadn't been broken in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So now I've been appropriately corrected, but at that age, I was just like, I'll play freeze. That looks like this, that looks like this. Like, I was way too eager to get in there, but that ended up being a good thing. I just wanted, all I wanted to do were scenes with two people talking, like New York improv. Like, I just wanted just two people on a bus talking.
And then you eventually do move here after college. You're 22,
yes.
Something like that. You've just tried stand-up a little.
Uh-huh.
You've just gotten married,
mm-hmm.
which I have to ask you, crashing doesn't deal with this, but how did you decide to get married at 22? Because someone from comedy were like, married at 22 because it's like, you know, that's you don't have a chance in your career.
Right, right. You also know you're about to get swallowed by a pretty ambitious pursuit. You know?
Right.
You need a lot of time. You need a lot of free time. It's not great advice.
So,
I got married when I was 22 because I was religious. I was Christian, evangelical, Protestant Christian.
That's pretty
and,
Christian.
Those words could mean anything.
You can, right.
But I took it seriously. Meaning I know a lot of evangelical Protestant Christians that weren't really into it. I was really into it.
How did that work when you started to do improv? Because I would imagine there's certain things you wouldn't, yeah.
It's a great question because I was on the improv team when I was in college. I went to Christian college. And improv is actually kind of perfect if you want to like be a little bit naughty. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? If you do stand up, it's prepared and people are like, you should know better. But if you're improvising, like I used to get in trouble a lot for saying bastard. That was like one of those words that was kind of on the line.
Mm-hmm. Still is.
Like, you bastard. And everyone would be like, oh, like they were, but it was great. Like,
was there a lot of sexual tension stuff going on?
Totally, there was every kind of
tension. When I do corporate stuff, sometimes you're like, don't do this, don't they do
this. But that's what I'm saying, they want you to do it a little bit.
Yeah.
So if you're one of them, if you're a student at a Christian college performing for Christian students, and you go to that school,
right?
They really need it. You know what I mean? I kind of try to remember that whenever I'm doing comedy, is like, these people made a lot of effort, you know, in the real world to get to the show. Even in college, they still have a deep need for release, especially a Christian community. Somebody that, you know, I have a big heart for. They're pledging to a certain code of ethics. And, like, where does entertainment fall in that? A lot of stuff isn't really for them. So if you're doing kind of PG, sometimes PG-13 improv, they loved it. And that's when I really, I'm glad I went to a small Christian school. I don't necessarily agree with my school on everything, but I like that I got to be a comedian. It was easy to be a comedian there. Because there was so much to make fun of.
So it really helped you with your confidence?
It helped me with my confidence. It was just like, it was also a small pond. You know what I mean? If you were, I mean, I think I was good at it. And then you became like a little campus, not celebrity, but like the group became very popular. My only regret, and if I can give advice to anybody that's doing improv, especially in college, just do a show every week. I don't understand. We would do it like twice a year or three times a year. It's like, why? It was improv, like, and we knew different games and stuff. We should have been performing every week. I think we were afraid people would stop coming, but who cares, you know?
So in 2001, you come to Chicago, mm-hmm. and you're on the hot improv team in your school. Yeah. What was it like to try?
And so was everyone who moved here. Everybody that moved to Chicago in 2001 was a sandy blonde, tall college improv celebrity that was like, I'll just do what Farley did. It was everybody from their college improv team that thought they were good.
So how do you break in?
I still don't know. Okay. I mean, like, I have no idea because I was just remembering today that I auditioned for Second City for the conservatory. And I went in and, you know, there's A, B, and C, which is the basics, and then there's 1, 2, and 3, which is the advanced. And I wanted to do the advanced. I felt like I had been doing improv for
10 years by now, right?
Basically, yeah. But it turns out not really great improv.
Right.
I was doing kind of short form and kind of weak stuff, and I didn't know. So I auditioned, and I did very poorly. I still remember that audition. I actually said, we were on a boat. To this day, I still have a phobia of doing improv scenes on boats because you can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not that you want to go anywhere. I just don't like feeling that I'm trapped in a scene. Like, literally, like, it's just this area, and that's the sea. Like, what, am I going to swim? I don't like it. So I was on a boat, and I was like, at one point, just for trying hard for a laugh, I just went, where the hell are we going? And I felt so bad that I had asked a question. I didn't get it. And then I realized I.O., no disrespect to I.O., but I was like, I was so serious about it. And I felt like a lot of the class system was just like, as many people as possible, and repeat the lessons as many times as possible. Not as necessary, but as possible. So by level 3, when I felt like I was learning what we had already learned in level 2, just kind of like a little bit deeper, I was like, I need the crash course or something. I need to do this every day for 8 hours, because I need to start performing. I don't want to do, what was it, 90 minutes once a week? I was like, this isn't enough for me. So then I went to the playground. Do they still have the playground?
They still have the playground, yeah.
And I got on an incubator team, and that was one of the best things I did, because they actually let you perform. It was for each other. It was a little bit like an open mic. But at least it was free, I was broke, and I got to be on a stage performing.
What were you good at in improv?
Great at the last line. I would always find the line that was like, and you call yourself a doctor, blackout. Like, I was very good at that. I think almost every show we had, I got the last line, the button on the scene. And I was also good at initiations. Like, I really like the challenge of loading a lot of information into something. Like, commissioner, you said blah, blah, blah. I can't think of one now, but you know what I'm saying. So, like, giving a lot of specifics.
And while you're here, you start to take stand-up seriously.
Well, while I was here, I worked at Bennigan's on 150 South Michigan, right around the corner.
I don't think that's still here, actually.
It's a CVS now.
Okay.
But right
you
by
you
the
went
Art
back
Institute.
And checked it out?
I did one time I was here.
Okay.
Not this time.
How was that, seeing that, you know,
it was
like...
surreal. Uh-huh. They still have the big windows where the big tabletops used to be.
I think in the pharmacy you still can get an Ultimate Nacho. I'm pretty sure.
Southwest Sampler, that was a big popular thing too. I remember, sorry, I lost my train of thought. What were we saying?
Joe, do you remember, Dan?
Stand up.
Oh, yeah, so I worked at Bennigan's, and I would... Irving Park Brown Line. So I live near the Lincoln Restaurant. Remember the
which
Lincoln
is
restaurant.
No longer either.
Yeah, nothing.
I'm
is
sorry
there.
To give you bad news.
I
this
know.
Is like a death notice.
I think it's a CVS, but you can still get the Lee Harvey Oswald omelet.
Yeah, in a skillet.
Lee Harvey omelet.
Yeah.
So anyway, on my walk to the train to the Irving Park Brown Line, I would pass the Lion's Den, which is also not there anymore, but it said, you know, Monday comedy, Tuesday whatever blues, Wednesday different things. And I was like, what does that mean, Monday comedy? But I was really scared to go in. But I would pass it every day. And I really think that was fortuitous because it really just kind of put an itch in my brain. I was like, what does that mean? I finally went, and it was an open mic. And this was the open mic that like Kumail Nanjiani and T.J. Miller and Matt Bronger, John Roy, Kyle Kinane, Hannibal Buress. It's a crazy deep bench of good people from Chicago. And I went in, and I always say I ended up doing stand-up. I moved to a city for improv, but I ended up doing stand-up.
You know, there's a story I read on the internet somewhere about you're having a conversation, I think, with Kumail. And you're in New York this time, and Kumail tells you, oh, by the way, Hannibal Buress is really funny now.
Yeah.
Can you share a little of that?
No,
what was he like when you were around? He was doing poetry? And
I don't remember if he was doing poetry. I know he had... I remember he had a bit about, it was like a hip-hop lyric bit. That's like a genre of joke, is like you take a lyric and you make fun of it. And it was like, I like girls with something, something, hoes, and I don't know if this was him. It might have been him. I'm going to say it was him.
Okay.
And then it'll be him.
Okay.
He said manicured toes, I think. And he was like, I think you mean pedicured toes. Like, that was the bit. So it was like kind of weird. Like, it was just kind of like, huh. And Hannibal just became known in the scene as somebody who did every show, but just was pretty, I don't know, pretty bad, I guess. Like,
I find that encouraging.
Yeah.
Do you?
That's why I like telling this story.
Yeah.
It's because Hannibal is one of my absolute favorites. I've told him this story to his face. He's aware.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like gossip. He was just this guy that we all kind of laughed. His name is Hannibal.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like Hannibal's here. And Hannibal was always there.
Mm-hmm.
He worked. He hustled a lot. And he'd go up and he just kind of was looking for it. And then one day I'm in New York and Kumail sends me an email. And I think the subject's like, you'll never guess who's funny. And the link was Hannibal. And I just started laughing. I was like, this has to be a joke. And I clicked on it and it was fantastic. And it should be encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, like, he started young and he figured it out. Like, he figured out what was special about him. Because, I don't know, one of the keys to show business is don't quit. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah.
I've heard.
Don't quit.
And then you things really take off when you move to New York, and you get a comedy special, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get this big break on the Pete Holmes show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on for 2 seasons, and then it gets canceled.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get over that disappointment? Because there's it's a skill set to do what you do, and there's only few people can do a late night talk show.
Yeah,
I imagine it was a big deal for you at the time. How do we go from that, getting over the disappointment, to creating Crashing?
Well, there's a couple answers to that. I'll try and remember all of them. One is kind of what we were talking about at the beginning, this idea that lightness and joy is something that you actually do get better at through practice, like not dwelling on stuff.
Can I have a pen? I need to write that down.
Okay. So there was that element, meaning I had already been living a life practicing to not... So a show gets canceled, and instead of getting like depressed, we were just like, okay, let's use the momentum. Me and my producing partner, Oren, we were like, instead of being sad or going out and getting a drink, we never did that. We never went out and got drunk or even had a piece of pie. There was no like moping. We were just kind of like, well, what are we going to do?
Have you always
next?
Been like that?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
It's unfortunate. I don't really deserve the spotlight or the credit because it does unfortunately come down a little bit to temperament. You know, they say 50%, I think it's 55% of your happiness is genetic, which is kind of messed up.
Then I am screwed.
And then, but 45 is elective activity.
Okay, because I came from like my parents, a lot of addiction, workaholism, all that.
So how? Too. I don't know what I did.
So, how rough was your childhood?
Just rough enough.
Okay.
I mean, just rough enough to make me funny, mm-hmm. and just rough enough to make, you know, not even funny. I mean, it did, but it made me a good listener, and it made me empathetic, and those things are really important.
But I got the same skills, but I got the self-sabotage. I got, when I get rejection, I want to sit in my bed with a coffee cake.
Yeah.
How did you get the, like, okay, great, okay, we got canceled.
Maybe I can demystify this for you, too, okay. is that we were doing a talk show, mm-hmm. and we would do 9 episodes a week, so we were lean. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, like, fast, mm-hmm. and muscly, and good, and we were just creating so much. And when you're in that sort of a vacuum, you're not even thinking about canceled or not canceled. It's more like an athlete that trains every day. And just because the show ends, you're still benefiting from that charge and mm-hmm. that discipline that you've kind of established because it was your job. And we just kind of made a choice to keep going with it. And then, so we set up meetings. We were like, our favorite thing to do was the sketches. There were 3 elements to the show, the interview, the sketch, and the monologue. And we were like, well, we could just go to Comedy Central. We thought it was easy. We'll go to Comedy Central. We'll pitch a sketch show. And we did. And in the first, like, 10 minutes, so this is maybe 4 or 5 days after the show was canceled, to us, it wasn't public yet. And we went in, and in the preamble, before we got to why we were there, they kind of jokingly were like, well, one thing's for sure, we don't need another sketch show. And we were like, holding coffee. You know what I mean? So then we just kind of acted like we didn't have a reason for the meeting. We were just kind of like, we just want to check in. And we left. And I was sitting, so here, Jimmy, you can relate to this. I'm in my car, and now I'm telling you all the emotions. I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling low. It's starting to hit me. Maybe this plan of optimism isn't going to work. Maybe I'm going to, you know, get hit in the stomach here. And I sat with that for a minute. And then I was just kind of like, well, what would I do if I could do anything? And that, I think that's a valuable question. And I was like, well, I think I love the show, single camera shows. I love Girls, you know, shows like Louie. And I'm just like, well, what is my Girls? I was like, well, it would be about a religious guy who doesn't have any money and isn't very good, but his wife leaves him, and he's kind of kicked into the New York stand-up scene, which is what happened. But then in that kind of desperation, not optimism, out of desperation, I was like, well, it seems like, oh, he could be crashing on different people's couches. Just like that. It just kind of came in that low moment in my car. And I was like, well, that sounds like a show. Like, as opposed to just going in and being like, you know, it's about a religious guy whose wife leaves. You get to give them that engine. That helps in pitches. It's something that shows, paints the picture in their mind. This is how you would do it week to week. I'm with Artie, then I'm with this person, then blah, blah, blah. So not only did I have the idea, but it seemed very much like a Judd Apatow idea. It's kind of like Knocked Up, wife leaving instead of baby being made. And it's a little bit like 40-Year-Old Virgin instead of Steve Carell just being like a nerd. This is a religious guy who's never hit on a woman or done a drug. So those two elements were there, although I didn't realize that until later. It just felt like a Judd idea. So that was a Wednesday, and then I flew to New York.
Now, how do you have the confidence to ask? I've had a lot of people, this is what I struggle with too, is asking. To ask Judd Apatow, hey, I've got this idea.
I totally understand. And as you say that, I'm like, maybe, I don't know, maybe that behavior's been reinforced in me because it wasn't shamed in me. Kind of my whole life, I remember learning, like, my dad, I'll give you an example of when it didn't work. He was like, you gotta ask for what you want, Peter. So I remember I would call comedy clubs and just ask for spots. And I'd call every day. I'd just be like, hi, it's Pete Holmes again. Just wondering if there are any spots. And finally, always voicemails. One guy, the guy picks up the phone, he's furious at me. He's just like, this isn't how it works. And I was this big. I mean, like, it really was traumatic. It doesn't sound that bad.
No, I feel the shame.
But a grown man yelled at me. And I was like 20, 21.
Right.
And I was like, oh, sorry.
Right.
And I kind of got that, you know, the electric shock. So I learned, not always, but at a certain point, I think I just had enough belief in myself. I think I had an over-loving mother. I don't know if you can relate to that.
No.
And then I had a somewhat withholding father, meaning he was working a lot. He's very loving, but he was not around as much as my mom.
I can relate to that.
So that's a good combo for me, is that I had mom telling me my poop smell like roses, and then my dad being not that impressed. So that's a good combo. So I think that sort of psychology gave me the confidence to be like, well, I have a talk show idea. We should pitch it to Conan. I have a single cam idea. I'm just going to pitch it to Judd. But he had done my podcast maybe 6 months earlier. So I had finally met him, and we had done a sketch for the Pete Holmes Show. So we met twice. And that's really where some good track laying was done. It wasn't intentional, but the contact was made. We did a funny show together. My manager set that up. He got Judd on the podcast, which is, I like to joke, that's why I can never fire my manager. But he's great. He introduces me to Judd. And then 6 months later, I had an idea that was right for Judd. I believed that it was right for Judd. If I felt like I was just pitching it to him because he was like a Hollywood deal maker, maybe I wouldn't have been as confident. But I was like, I think he'll at least hear it. It's 15 minutes out of his day. That's a very privileged position. But I was like, I think I have a good idea. I didn't know just how lucky I was in the timing of it, that he actually had the RAM drive to take on another project. I also didn't know at the time how lucky I was that I was pitching a show about starting in stand-up while he was starting back into stand-up. Those are two really fortuitous things. But I flew in on a Thursday night or something, 6 a.m. on Friday. I met him on the set of Trainwreck. We talked for 12 minutes. The last 3 minutes, I pitched him the show. And this is where I think the rubber really meets the road, is he said, I like it. He didn't even say, I like it. He was just like, that's interesting, or whatever he said, something cryptic, non-committal, which I've learned with Judd, you have to be. You can't be like, I like it, because people will take it to mean, I'm in showbiz now, I guess. He was like, go write it. And I wrote it. I wrote the pilot 2 days later, based on kind of what we had chatted. And then he read it, and he was like, write another one. And I wrote another one, like the second episode. I wrote that 2 days later. I sent it to him. We did that 5 times. So it wasn't just like, moxie. Like, when he said write it, I wrote it. And when he said write it again, I wrote it.
When he says that, do you have any expectations? That's where I screw up. Because I'll have someone like you on the show. I'm like, Pete Holmes is going to say, Jimmy Crane's amazing. I got to put him on the next episode of Crashing.
Right.
That's what's always in my head.
That's great. I think that's good.
I understand that. But it doesn't happen. Does that turn into bitterness? Yes. Yes, it does turn into bitterness.
Yeah.
Well, resentment usually first and then bitterness.
Yeah.
So how do you work on something and you're like, well, I don't know. Like, put your whole heart into it, knowing that maybe this isn't going... Judd Apatow's going to say, look, you kind of give you the brush off.
I think it's, again, training ourselves. And I don't have this figured out, by the way. I want you to know that I hear what you're saying. And bitterness and lowness and disheartenedness are things that we all have to deal with in this business. I will say that as a stand-up, and I'm sure you can relate, I've dealt with so much rejection in real time that you start to just get a little bit, I'm not saying invincible, but you get a little bit less, you get more resilient towards it. So it's like, I've had sweat recently dripping down my face because I'm bombing. So how bad is it going to be if nothing happens? Like, at least my heart's not going to jack up and my mouth isn't going to get dry. And also, like, I drew cartoons for The New Yorker. I would hand in 10, 15 cartoons every week for 6 months before they bought one. So you just get, like, that's one of the things that Crashing is about, is that if it sucks, you know you're doing it correctly. And that it's just like, well, just stay in the ring, you know what I mean? It's like Rudy. We're all Rudy. And none of us are that great at football, but it's just like, I'm just going to stick into this, unless you're Mulaney.
What do you mean by that?
I'm just saying, if I'm the metaphor being comedy is football, Mulaney's very good at comedy. Meaning, I'm helping relate. There are some people that I look at and I'm like,
how does he do it at that young age?
When they gave
John Mulaney, you're talking
when
about.
When Conan was like, we want you to host the show, I was like, I think I made the joke. I was like, have you heard of John Mulaney? Like, what are you doing? It's crazy.
Oh, like he should have the job?
Yeah.
Do you compare yourself and get jealous of other people?
No.
How do you do that one? Because I am jealous of everyone I started with in Chicago.
That's
how do you do that?
I think, again, I'm not writing you off, but I think it would be pretentious for me to pretend like I could tell you how.
Uh-huh.
I did, it's sheer pragmatism. I noticed that people that really get consumed by what other people are doing, they all quit. And I learned that early on. I was fortunate. It's almost like, why don't I smoke cigarettes? It would be like, well, both my parents died of lung cancer because they smoked. It's not that, but when I started comedy, there were so many people, like Aziz was like 20, right, and he shot up so fast. In our little scene way, he was in the Rolling Stone hot list. He was passed at a couple clubs, and we were all jealous of him. I started noticing that, like, there were some people, Mulaney, Eugene Merman, Nick Kroll, that loved Aziz, that didn't hate on him. And then the people that did, you could go hang out with them and it might be funny to be like, fuck that guy. Those guys all sucked and they all quit. Because, not because they were talentless, but because they let the, you could almost see the black going in their veins and like some Harry Potter movie. They were just going to the dark side. So I was like, it's not just trying to be a good guy, it's literally good business to shield yourself from jealousy.
This is going to take me a lot while to get over. I am getting better at it. The thing that I love about crashing is you're so vulnerable. It's a side of you that we haven't seen that much. And you're talking about being divorced. You were married for 6 years. You walk in and your wife is having an affair.
Yeah.
How cathartic is, and starting out doing stand-up and sucking at it, how cathartic is this show for you?
Again, maybe this will help. In doing the show, I go, oh, I could never do it again. Like, I could never start comedy again. Like, it's so hard.
You're like, oh, my God, it's harder than I thought.
How did we do it? Yeah, how did we even do it? Because we didn't know. I have to imagine you were the same way. You didn't even know how difficult it was. You didn't even know how much crow you were going to have to eat night after night after night. Because it does hurt. Like, bombing even pretend hurts. But there is something nice about being able to yell cut at the end of it. And or you know you're paying for the club. And it's your set that day. And even though you're playing a mousy small guy, it's still, you know, your production. And there is kind of some catharsis there.
Did some stuff come up about your first marriage? Like, oh God, yeah. I might have done this differently. Or, oh, I felt really sad about it. Because
I don't have too many feelings of like, because I'm glad. I know it sounds like somebody gets stabbed and they're like, oh, I'm glad I was stabbed. I am glad that it ended. I don't have any fantasies like I wish we were still together. But watching and writing the show and making the show did help me have even more perspective on like what I wasn't providing.
I would imagine when we got divorced, there was probably a lot of anger towards her, I would guess.
Yeah, anger's a hard emotion for me. It was hard for me to
give
access.
Me a call. I'll sponsor you in anger if you.
You know, I bet we would be friends because yeah. I love people who can access darker emotions, or maybe not even darker, just more volatile, more exciting, electric emotions. And I actually learned to get into it through stand-up. Like, I'll get mad about some trite thing, but it actually feels really good.
But you had said something that you, when you wrote the character of your ex-wife in the show, you had enough distance to make her more, to be more compassionate.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if that helped even heal you a little from that.
Absolutely. I've said before, I think it would be a good therapy lesson for anybody to script a situation that's upsetting you from the other person's perspective.
And then get it shot and have like an HBO, you know, two seasons
yeah,
on an HBO
definitely,
show.
Definitely.
For me, that would be better than all the years that I've been in group therapy twice a week for 10 years.
Oh, that's so
the other
funny.
Thing I love about it is sad comedy. I love sad comedy. It's
yeah.
something that we haven't seen. We got to wrap this up. So, so how do you make sad comedy work? Because I'd like to see more sad comedy.
That's an interesting thing. I'm glad you like it. I love it too. I'm always ready for someone to be like, gee, your show isn't like a slapstick riot or something. And I always want to say, comedy isn't a comedy. And I know you know that. It's mm-hmm. like, it's serious stuff. And life isn't really all a comedy. I think we're seeing this new trend. And fortunately, the palette of American viewers or just global viewers is sophisticated enough now that we like shows that have everything. And one of the great things about doing a show about comedians going through hard times is even when my wife is leaving me, I'm making jokes, you know, or even when I'm depressed, I'm making jokes. And that's believable, not because we're living in some made-up world like a show like Wings or Cheers, which are great shows. It's just because comedians are always joking, especially when they're low, I think. So that's one of the keys. I think that's one of the reasons we see so many shows about comedy people and show business people is because they're always trying to have some outsider perspective on their circumstance.
Pete, we got to wrap this up. One last question we
sure.
ask everyone on the podcast. What one piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv or stand-up comedy today?
I mean, we covered some of it, and it bears repeating, so I'm going to include it in my answer, is that like surround yourself with the right, let's get 1960s here, with the right vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
Like you want to be with people that have similar goals to you and that have a similar vibe to you, which is supportive and inclusive. You might find that more in improv, although there's backstabbing in both fields. And then the other thing that I think is kind of liberating is that, like, I can't really tell you what to do because it's always changing. Listen to the number of places I listed that are now closed. You know, like, my advice doesn't really
Bennigan's, CVS, Lion's Den, Lincoln Restaurant.
Yes, but...
No, CVS is still open.
CVS is doing great. You know, Dwayne Reed owns CVS. I'm
okay.
But getting on stage as much as possible, I bet people are frustrated sometimes hearing that advice, but it's just so true, is getting up on stage as much as possible. And Joe and I were talking about this too. It's like figuring out who you are is not only one of the keys to being happy and feeling fulfilled, but it's one of the keys to having like a really good comedy career. What makes you angry? What makes you sad? What makes you joyful? And bring all of that. This is Bill. I'm kind of reusing Bill Hicks's advice. He says, the more you are your authentic self, the more you'll have supply and demand covered. Because only you can be Jimmy perfectly. And only I can be Pete perfectly. So someone can kind of do the sort of stuff that I do, but they can't be the full picture of me. And anybody that's just doing an impression of me or an impression of you, they're not giving the real goods. And people can feel it. That's what makes Mulaney so great, is he's being Mulaney. He's being a Midwest Catholic guy who's very smart, you know what I mean?
Pete Holmes, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv News.
I just plugged Mulaney. Crashing is on January 4th. I'm just kidding. It's on HBO on Sunday nights.
Check it out. It's great.
I appreciate that.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Pete Holmes, and check out his show, Crashing, which is premiering its second season on HBO. I'd also like to thank Dan Schiffmacher. He's the producer. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. And of course, I want to thank the good people at HBO for setting this up. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and also sign up for the Improv Nerd newsletter. Each week, I send you out an original blog that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Well, I can't promise the better person part, but it will help your improv. Follow us on social media. We are taking over social media. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. Also, Facebook, like our Improv Nerd fan page, because it really helps my low self-esteem. And, of course, our YouTube channel and our Patreon campaign. I think that's pretty... Oh, Feral Audio. I want to thank being part of Feral Audio. Check out all the great podcasts at feralaudio.com. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, he's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I'm a rich...
I don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My